December.
Okay.
So this is a session where I put some responsibility on you to ask questions. Subject is our spiritual practice. That can include technical matters of practice, but it's also our whole life. Anything that we need to know on this path, how to work with our human function. Anyway, anything that you want to ask, not necessarily narrowly within our tradition. So, okay. If some help, we will. Soldier Karen might even ask him some questions. One thing I want to do, Soldier Gandhi, is I want to record the Gould Bank that you recited. I want to make some recordings of some of the Sema prayers. So, what shall we talk about this afternoon? Yes, Matthew, okay, we can. It's good. Let's use the microphone for recording purposes.
I have a question about, practice. So, on our basics of practice on the website, it talks about the two most important places to focus our. Oh, is it not?
One, two, three.
It says the two most important places for us to focus awareness are the heart center and the third eye. And almost all of my practice, I'm aware, is really centered in my heart center. And yeah. That's what I've most cultivated. And I haven't really done much at all with putting awareness here. And I wonder which of our practices, which of our practices would we focus there and when would we focus there? And why and how?
It's a good question. And this is something that was written quite a few years ago. And over time, our perspectives change a little bit. So let's see if we can talk about the third eye. And it's not called that in Sufism, but it's known as the center of knowing. You could even say it's associated with the system of Latifas. So it's true. We're not even recommending specifically that you focus on the third eye during most sitters. The time when you would potentially focus on the third eye is any of the divine names. Okay, good. Where is this going? Any of the divine names that have an Isa, like Ali. So, even Rahim, but some of them are really have a strong Isan. Aleem being a good one. Think of Aleem. It's the all-knowing capacity of God. And our knowing, of course, is not limited to this point between the eyebrows, which is what we call it in Sufism. And we don't even point to it. They're little fine points of the tradition. You never say, well, what about this? No. Jesus might refer to it. And interestingly, esoterically, two bow lengths, probably called same, two bow lengths, is a hint. So I would say, and no one's asked that question in 20 years. Thank you. The divine names, Aleem, which is about knowing. And if you're doing that as a zikr aloud, you could really have some awareness centered in that point. There's no doubt, you know, in the Indian systems, both Hindu and Sufic, they really do focus on these points. The Levy tradition, not so much. But nevertheless, it is a kind of knowledge that's already to have. In the Indian, in the Shishti system, for instance, the different sounds have resonances in different parts of the body. Who you sound is here, the throat. The ah sounds the heart. And the ih sounds the solar plexus. La, ila, il, Allah. So, la, la, ila, la is very grounding zikr. And its effect is here in the belly, the solar plexus, and the heart, of course. Another one, well, a name like Azim, which is a very high, beautiful name. It has both in that point between the eyebrows, which with the M sound, it resonates in this crown, what would be called the crown chakra. So in doing the zikr of Azim, it leads up to the crown. So that's useful to know. What are the names have that E sound?
Kareem.
What is it? Kareem? Kareem, yeah. Kareem has it.
Kareem.
Hakim, yeah. Obviously, Hakim has something to do with knowing, especially knowing God's laws. Wisdom, hikmah. The meaning of wisdom, if you look at the words, hikmah, is the knowledge, the wise knowledge and wise use of God's laws. Knowing the hukum. Sometimes people think of hukum in the sense of laws, like laws where you could break the law and get punished for it. Well, that's partly true, but the laws here mean more like principles of divine manifestation, the spiritual laws, not the commands, not the prescriptions, not the fiqh. So the wise, the hakim, the wise healer, can only be a wise healer by understanding spiritual and natural laws. And that produces hikmah, which is also in Hebrew, chokmah. Yes, my brother.
Now, for something in this.
Please.
A lower where it's not mentioned as a verb or I, there is a fundamental practice of it. For example, you have the sujood.
Oh, yeah.
Sujood, if you know, the tradition says, and the way the Prophet would say it, is that he said, keep your attention on the point of sujood. People think it's the point on the ground. It also be this point. Yeah. So when you breathe, you can direct the breath from the heart to the head into the point in the ground.
Yes.
And as Madonna said in the passage we read earlier, pass into sight. Pass into sight.
And the breath can be directed anywhere in the body just by intention. What we call the breath is not just the physical breath, but there's always a subtle energy riding the breath if we're conscious of it. So you can move the breath anywhere in the body for healing purposes, for energizing purposes. And that's beautiful, the beauty of the what is sometimes called entering into the oblivion of the sajda, becoming nothing in that sajda. Prostration when the thought, it touches the ground. had interesting experiences when once we were doing a workshop at Esalen with a group of sort of psychotherapists, clinicians, corporate-type people, and we were asked to do heart practices. So I invited this group of people, and I took them through standing, bowing, and prostration. And it blew people away because they'd never touched their foreheads to the ground. And the body knows something in that posture that it doesn't know in any other way. And if you have it in Buddhist practice, you have it in Orthodox Christianity, you used to have it in Judaism. Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, before he was crucified, fell on his face and prayed.
Thank you. Intellectually, one understands that there is only one reality. So my perception is perception. Experientially, my perception seems like it belongs to me in isolation. And the question that came, I kind of came to an answer, the question that came was, does my perception have to become nothing so that his perception can, you know, so the perception then becomes known from,
yes,
myself becomes known from the perspective of the one reality.
Yeah.
Or is it the case that one comes to the point where one sees one's mind perception as the perception of the one reality? So that perception of mind becomes known as the one perception. So transformed rather than going to zero and replaced.
Yes. There's no going to zero in my experience.
Yeah.
So let's clarify our language a little bit. We could say, sometimes we use the word reality in an ultimate, absolute sense. Mutlak, gerçeklik, mutlakak. But also, but we can use it this way too. You have your reality, I have my reality. People have many different realities. For them, it's their reality. It's not the reality. But we can use the word that way. It's, you know, it makes sense to say that we each have a different reality. But we know there can't be many different realities in truth. So we can say the way this is handled is to say there is one truth. There's one hawk. There aren't many hawks. It's one hawk, one truly real. But we have different realities and different perspectives on things. So it's really just a process of purifying ourselves of our particular distortions without ever expecting that there's some absolute that we're going to attain. It's enough for us to just look at what are obvious distortions in our perception. And emotional judgment, when you get kind of, you know, stirred up and you're blaming something out there, that's always a distortion.
Yeah.
Always. It's not that all things out there are blameless or equal. But when emotions get involved and blame gets involved, it's obviously a distortion. How would a real, what they call the Mershi Kamyo, see things? We tell a story. This is a story of Kenan the Five, a beautiful story. He was a Mershi in Istanbul, lived, probably died in the 50s. So one day he's at the window of his apartment and he's looking out on the street. He's standing there with his wife and he sees a man just starts peeing on the lamppost that's up. And the wife goes, oh, what a dirty thing. And 10 under 5 looks at it and says, isn't it marvelous the way the body can eliminate toxins? So that's a changing scene, you know, a perspective. So this leads to another principle or a bit of advice. Sometimes people get all tangled up in knots thinking, oh, is there, if I want to do something, is that ego? Or I begin to get really worried. Is everything I'm thinking ego? Is everything I want just a manifestation of ego? And simple advice for people at our level is, if you need to eliminate something from your life, from your consciousness, start with your negativity. Get rid of your negativity, and then see what's left. Leave your complaining, leave your anger, leave your blame. You can safely do all of that, and you'll all be the better for it. And then see what's left. If somebody arrives at that state, come see us. We'll talk about this. Yes, Sabina.
My question actually came in the previous session. It talks about the heart being six-dimensional mirror and being judged through the six dimensions. So I was thinking.
Six directions. We don't need to get into complex dimensional theory with this. There are six directions, as there are in Native American spirituality. There's up, down, north, south, east, and west. Yeah. That's enough. That's enough. Keep it simple. I mean, that's amazing in itself, that we have these directions, three-dimensional space-time. In truth, this is a concept. There is no such thing as a dimension. A dimension doesn't exist. There's no point in existence. There's no pure line in existence. There's no pure plane in existence. There are only things that are three-dimensional space-time, maybe four-dimensional. But that's simply up, down, north, south, east, and west. That's the case, sir.
Okay, just questions. I want to ask two questions. I might ask only one. But one of the things that talking about in terms of practice, I remember at one time, and Sujuwa is really important, obviously, for lots of reasons. And I remember being in a mosque somewhere, I'm not going to mention where it was. I remember being in a mosque once. And I think I was in Sujood a little bit too long because someone came up to me trying to get me up. And I'm just wondering, is it possible to be in Sujood for too long?
It may be possible, I can't say it's impossible. To be in situ too long. But I think what's going on here, I'm guessing, but there are those who believe that Islam is about external practices. And for instance, I've been told that in Egypt recently, if you were to stop and meditate in the Great Pyramids, the guards would come and move you along or get you moving, they wouldn't allow you to stop and meditate. And I've seen the same thing at the Dome of the Rock, where the Palestinian guards would not allow people to go into interior practice. So this is a Wahhabi attitude, that no, Islam is just what you do outwardly. You don't need to do anything inwardly. I think that's probably what was going on in your case. Now, we have accounts from our own tradition, don't we?
Yeah. In the accounts from the flocking, there are stories of people beginning to pray with prayers with Lana, and he would go into Rukuja's bow and be pausing there so long they finished their whole prayer. And then they looked at each other and they said, well, I guess we better go. And they came back a week later and he was just making his frustration. So, you know, we have these stories, and the prophet said to hold each posture until we find that ease. That resonance. So in this outer world, sometimes people, you know, have schedules or they have concepts of how things will be done. And also, I mean, if we're doing prayer together, there's something to be said for moving in that wave together. But it's beautiful to linger in frustration.
How does Anna happen to be in Jerusalem, actually? And I found that a little bit interesting because I wasn't sure. Because there's also that Rumi poem about frustrating in front of the door battery. I just lying there, which is a miracle. I love that. No, I'm not laughing.
Jeremy?
I'm sometimes concerned that my Kamalite spiritual practice is not normative. And there's a degree of inflation perhaps around it. I didn't mean to walk in sicker because that seems totally okay to me. But a lot of the Siddhartha I do is not normative. I do it walking. I do it lying down. Not after my accident. I had to do it lying down for a long time. So I developed a practice where I visualize myself standing in my heart. And when I do the prayer and say the words, I do all the motions. I identify with that image of myself in the heart. I practice it that way. But I'm very aware that, because when you're doing that walking down the street, there are distractions. So I just wondered whether, well, should I revert to totally to the normative practice, or should I not be too concerned about this variation that I've developed in the practice of Siddhartha?
Great, thank you for this. Is a very important question for a lot of reasons. So, Jeremy's asking, should he revert to the normative, that is, the orthodox Sharia prescribed practices? Then the question would be, well, why? Why would you do that? Because somebody is defining Islam for you? Because there's some authority who presents to you a program and says that this is the program, this is the only way it's to be done? It's to see things more that way at one time. Over time, I myself became more flexible. My reasons, justifications for approaching with flexibility and trying to get to the essence of what ibadah, what worship is for, I think this is justified in the Quran. If you take the Quran as the final reference point for the religion of Islam, which I do, and not the Hadith, if they add something that's not in the Quran. The Quran is very general. It says, yes, establish prayerfulness in your life. But it doesn't exactly, it never describes the form at all. And it doesn't even describe, it certainly doesn't describe the number of, you know, bows and prostrations. And it doesn't even accurately describe the times of prayer. So what we are being enjoined to do, if we take the revelation of the Quran as I do, as a universal revelation. Yes, it's also a revelation for the community of Muhammad, but in another sense, it is from the vast intelligence that was not necessarily intending to create one new religion on this planet that was going to push around other religions or supersede other religions. It is, can be seen as a message to humanity about what is really important. So if we take Quran at its word, it says, establish Aqim as-Salat. In other words, make this prayerfulness stand up in your life. And there are many ways to do that. That's the most important thing. However, I also have to say that the postures, everything about the form itself is extraordinary. Extraordinary benefit physically, emotionally, how it gathers a human being into a single wholeness. And if we understand that and have experienced that, we will appreciate that. And we will ask ourselves with our intelligence, is this salat in this prescribed form going to be of benefit to my soul? I think that's would be a good reason to ask the question about any of these practices, including ablution. Ablution is very beautiful. And yet, if you make it a problem in your life, that you're not in a state of ablution, or I can't get to my ablution and I feel bad about that, if you make it into a problem, it's probably not what it's for. But when you realize the beauty of running cool water over the sensitive areas of your body, it is a process of deconditioning. There's an electromagnetic deconditioning. One feels in a very different state, more prayerful, more conscious. And there's a profound wisdom in it. And so I think we can look at these key practices, keep it simple, but value them. I personally feel deprived in the last 2 years that I haven't been able to do kneeling and prostration the way I used to. It's a loss to me. I hope I may still be able to get back to it. But to me, it's a loss. I can pray sitting, as you see me with you, and that's good. Yes, Jeremy?
But if you are imagining in this imaginary salat, all the movements that you want to do, I imagine myself standing, bowing, prostrating. I'm feeling in my imagination, my head, touching the carpet.
I get it
right.
Let me tell you.
Is there a difference between that dimension of prayer and the actual physical act of prayer?
You know,
it's a difficult
Studies have shown that especially older women who maintain the ritual prayer, you know, into their later years, are saved from osteoporosis and other things. They're benefited by continuing to do the physical prayer. But the interesting thing is that those women that do what you're suggesting are also benefited and also saved to some extent from osteoporosis by the imaginative performance of these rituals. So.
And likewise, Sulaimane used to recommend that when one was learning the turn, the whirling, to turn at least 18 times a day. And if you were unable because of illness or whatever, to still keep that connection, but similarly, to visualize and make the turning internally. So these realms resonate.
This is very interesting, and I'm curious whether Seljuk has heard anything like this. But, Seljuk, do you think there is some good in doing the sema in your mind, you know, inwardly just visualizing it. Do you understand the question?
Yeah.
Is there something useful in that? Has any post-Nishin ever talked about this, or have you experienced anything like this in the tradition?
I explain the Turkish is a bit better. Mm-hmm. Bana yansıması, yani semanın içindeki yansıma tabii her dört step'ten oluştuğu için, dört şeyden, bölümden oluşuyor sema. Tabii her selamın anlayışı ve yansıması farklı oluyor.
Sema consists of four steps, and the reflection that one receives from each step is different.
Bunda tabii o anki halimizin, yani o günkü halimizin, o yansımalarda, o günkü halimizin, o gün icra edilen müziğin de, icra edilen ayinin de, yani okunan o ayin-i şerifin de etkisi var tabii. O da bizi, bunları, o ortama hazırlayan etken oluyor.
The way that day evolves and the ayin during the ceremony, all those elements contribute to the conditioning of and the realization of the sema, the music, and this happens to be at that moment, and it can change from moment to moment.
Yani çok böyle, yani anın içinde tabii. Çok büyülü bir şey. Yani şimdi.
It is magical to be within the moment.
Çünkü o seyranın içinde, yani şöyle bir şey, yani seyir var, seyir içinde. Seyir nasıl?
Seyir, journey.
Journey,
there's journey within journey.
Yani biraz da böyle tuzaklarla dolu gibi.
And there are some traps sometimes.
Şöyle söyleyeyim, yani hani şimdi bir şeyin içine katıldığın zaman, yani onun içinde giderken birden bir uyanıklık gelip kendini gördüğünde, hani işte ona hep böyle bizim ilahilerde de vardır, yani seyir var, seyir içinde, hani içindeki şeyin sonsuzluğu, rahmeti, yani rahmaniyeti çok büyük olduğu için, hani bir yere kadar nasip olan kadar da kullanabiliyoruz bu enerjiyi.
Okay. It's journey within journey, and each person takes away from it according to his capacity. And I'm missing one other thing.
Huge mercy in the journey itself. So huge that one is blessed just to feel a bit of it. So even in our glasses, in everything, we are warning ourselves that there are steps on the journey, there is a journey within the journey, because the mercy is so huge that it's almost natural to be caught in the trap.
By the way, Sabina is a professional translator.
Let's see what she's got.
Come on. I was impressed with
you. No, it's my third.
There is one ein that impresses me most.
Ein is a ceremony, a bloody ceremony.
Beati,
makam beati. Makam beati.
Orada mesela yani çok bilmiyorum artık bana hitap eden bir şey mi geliyor artık ayin-i şerif mi geliyor. Çok eski bir ayin-i şerif bu. Mesela onda bir şey hissediyorum. Yani semada en keyif aldığım şey, en bana lezzet veren an sema ederken artık her şeyin durduğu bir nokta var. Yani her şey duruyor. İşte o açıklığı seviyorum yani. Ama o bir anda oluşuyor ve yani onun içinde çok uzun süre kalamıyorsunuz.
This ayin is my favorite and I don't know whether it's something that is revealed only to me, that is communicated, that I feel personally. But there is one moment during doing sema, which is the moment when I take most pleasure from. And that's a very tiny moment when I realize during my whirling that everything has stopped. The moment of realization that everything has stopped. And sometimes it's very short, comes and goes, but to me it's the most pleasurable moment.
Yes, Matrix.
Sounds a bit like a magic.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. So I'll add a little something to this, which is that sometimes during zikr, when I'm leading zikr, I will visualize four semizens turning. And those four semizens are Muhammad, Ali, Shams, and Nirvana. Boom, boom, boom, and boom. And it's the most natural thing for me to, in a sense, see them. And when I remember to do that while leading zikr, I feel like I'm in very good company. Very happy, and I believe that it adds something to the zikr. Also, and you can translate this for Seljuk into Turkish too, that I think there's a beauty in just inwardly turning, doing the sema inside yourself, even when you can't do it physically.
Şimdi şöyle, mesela eskiden Galata Mevlevihanesi'ne çok yaşlı Mevleviliğe gönül vermiş insanlar geliyordu.
In the old Galata Mevlevi peki the old dervişes
eski yani çok yaşlı bayanlar ve erkekler Mevleviliğe gönül
There would many old people, all the men and women would come to the tekiye to express respect to the dervishes, to the devil.
Semaya çıktığımız zaman onların hepsi Nafi Şerif başladığında hepsi gözlerini kapatıp şöyle bir pozisyon alırlardı.
And when we would start the sema, the majority of those people would close their eyes with this position and express and greet us in that way.
Onlar dinlerler, bütün sema boyunca gözlerini açmazlar, hiç bakmazlardı yani. Onlar da kendi semalarını yapardı, biz onların enerjisini, onlar da bizim enerjimizi hissederdik. Ve hep birlikte yapardık o semayı esasında.
And I actually lived this experience throughout the whole Sema ceremony.
these old people would keep their eyes closed, and they would be doing the sena inside their heads. So while we were performing the actual sena, we would take their energy and they would take our energy. So that's what I felt and experienced. On body level, sema is actually very simple because it consists of three simple movements. But the important one is the sena of the soul, to actually make the soul start working. Sometimes that's the most difficult part, to bring the soul into working.
With the body.
Thank you for such a beautiful and deep exposition. Very touching. Yeah, just brought this up. My question was, you asked him to start some of the technicalities. I wanted to ask you that when you mentioned the Latif as understood as the subtle or the most subtle, I know there is a Sufi as well as a Sikh Hindu and Buddhist tradition that works with the sound of silence, the very, very high, and use that as a way of guiding their way back to God. For example, something that I use a lot as a practice. The second part of the question, which is again about the understanding of the, I don't know how it is here in your tradition when you work with what you call the zikr, that you work with directly with the subtle centers. For example, once being guided by some Ashtanga ways, when you use the La ilaha illallah, that's the left hand, the line comes from the bottom all the way up, and then it goes down. Ilaha illallah. So to keep, for example, working like that. So practice, for example, I developed for many years, and so I appreciate doing that as a kind of a way to, often in daily life, it's a very pleasant way to keep kind of feeling spacious and free, and also this very activated, and then come to rest in the supper silence at the same time. And I was just curious if you, since I speak your technique, you have the guidance or support around these things.
We're familiar with these spiritual technologies from a number of different lineages, and the Medleti path is simplified. It's very much simplified. And it's simplified because we've concluded, tradition in general and us personally, that there is no greater transforming power than love and relationship and direct dependence or relationship to, let's call it, the infinite. Being familiar with these technologies that bring a breath or a color to specific points in the body, for instance, as the Naqshbandis do with their latifas, or as the Chishtis do in a particular zikr, with swinging the head around and moving energies in various ways through the body. Some of these things have been influenced, the Chishtis have been influenced by Hindu tantric practices. Naqshbandis got it more directly from an unseen source, and yet there are different systems, so different lineages don't necessarily agree on the points, the colors, etc. So there's some element of subjectivity in this. But the what is developed in the human being, nevertheless, is developed in the human being, certain capacity for focus, for attention, even for the visualization of color and the movement of breath. All of these things are good and useful. They are not the ultimate answer, or perhaps they need to be appreciated with caution. If I were Naqshbandi, I would do what my sheikh tells me to do. But let's say, let me give you an example. Let's say you actually know someone who has done the course in some of these and has mastered these esoteric technologies. And then you find out, and you know that despite all of this, there was a moral failure of such proportions that it really puts into question the whole system itself. If a person could have that level of development in the spiritual technology, and I don't even want to go to the details of this, and the effect that this has had on me is just a very realistic view of these things. And brings us back to essentials like sincerity. Imagine there are a way to teach sincerity. Yeah. There are a way to embody love. There are a way to embody humility. So I haven't seen, I'm expressing an opinion, of course, but it's also my own experience. I have not seen the highest level of development of love and sincerity and humility, either in those who follow a rigid Islamic Sharia, nor in those who have mastered the spiritual technologies of Sufism, or Tantra, for that matter. So this brings us back to what really matters. What kind of development are we seeking for the human being? One of our teachers put it this way: if you could develop any attribute of the human being, what would it be? For instance, if you are breeding horses, what is a horse for? A horse is for riding. And maybe not only for that, but there's a beauty in a horse you can ride. And the relationship of horse to rider. Now, that horse would not be benefited by becoming as fat as a bull. So, developing the horseness in a horse, you focus on the beautiful qualities of the horse. If you're breeding a cow or bull for meat, you do something different. What is it in the human being that we want to grow and develop? It's a subtle question. But Sufism is one answer to that question. And especially the Mevlevi path, Rumi's path, which jumps right to the dimension of love with the statements like, love ends all arguments. Intellect always raises the question. Love is always the answer. and some principles like this. So our focus is a spirituality of relationship, service, but also of beauty, attainment and the expression of beauty. But along the way, we can't achieve these things unless we also develop skills of attention, self-awareness, an awareness that can be broad when necessary and very focused when necessary. An ability to hold one's, to remember one's intention under all kinds of circumstances. The proper use of will, defined as the ability of conscious choice. Be able to choose in any moment consciously what is in alignment with my highest understanding. So there's a practical side, which is why in our community here, well, the Mevlevi tradition accomplishes a lot of this training in the Mevlevi Sema and some other ceremonies we do, the Zikr ceremonies. You pick this, some of these things you pick up naturally in doing these rituals and these ceremonies. But we go a bit further, because not everybody is going to be a semizen. Not everybody is required to. So we have to develop our most characteristic human attributes. And one of them is certainly will. By will, I mean the ability to choose consciously and to choose even what is not in our self-interest. Because if our choice is only based on self-interest, it's also not free. So love enters the picture here. Love needs to be married to will, so that will can choose the good and not just what benefits me. So there's a whole silly-shaped structure of understanding the human being and what kind of human being do we want to develop. It's all of these things that reflect in our practical life. These things benefit us, you know, even if you're a barrister or a doctor or an athlete. All of these things contribute to doing those things well. But then we'll be reminded of what we read this morning, that portal to the ocean. You're a pitcher, but if your pitcher is connected to the ocean, you can pour the whole ocean. Or if your vision is connected to the infinite, then you have a connection to that infinite intelligence. But you need not only that connection to infinite intelligence, we also need the practical skills of remembering our intention, being the master of attention, and also being able to step back from the drives of the ego. Just to step back and almost view it. Sometimes we use the example of, it's like a dog on a leash. You know, are you going to train your dog, or if the dog doesn't have a leash or doesn't know how to behave and doesn't know how to respond to the commands of the master? Ego, the nafs, is just like that. It can be out of control, it can be destructive. But it's nice to see a well-trained dog. Do you like dogs? Appreciate dogs that are well-behaved and so forth. So sometimes we look at, there's a part of ourselves which is that dog. So at the lowest level, Sufism is training that dog. Actually, there's a good Rumi, Ghazal, I'll have to make a translation of it. Yes, no fear.
It's that really interesting questions and answers and responses. I'll come to the question. I've kind of sort of seen the words like system, tradition, orthodoxy as like increasing levels of rigidity. So we're talking about prayer, especially, because it's really questions around my own conditioning and what that belonged to myself on was the next question. And then the idea of the living tradition, that it's evolving, something changing, living, but something that remains solid. And also just the images of this difference between the imaginative and the practical. How my own system is very imaginative, but doesn't move very often to the practical. So I think just that imagining it, it's just as good as if it was actually doing it, physically moving my body and exercising. And so, yeah, my question comes to Salah, and I you were saying how it's good for the body, and I've often loved, I used to do yoga, and really loved the sun salutation, and the way it flows through my body, or flows through energy, and I don't know whether this would be, that this pushes orthodox into heterodox, but could you imagine Salah for the prayer being done in a sun salutation? I've sometimes thought of it, but I've never actually allowed myself to think that way.
Yes. You know, if your intention is worship, you can take any posture and yoga has many beneficial postures, many benefits for the body, we know that. But there's another benefit to Salah, which is something like this. You've heard of morphic resonance, Rupert Sheldrake's theory, that somehow it's as if there is, on some level of reality, morphic forms, and we resonate with them. So there is, if somebody were to come to you and say, you know exactly how Jesus prayed, would you like to know and experience the very same prayer that Jesus prayed? And it was not just a prayer of words, but as a movement or a posture. I would say, yeah, I would like to know. Now, if we practice the ablutions as Muhammad taught them, very specific ritualized form, not out of fear of doing it wrong, but with this idea of morphic resonance in mind. And if we pray in the postures that Prophet Muhammad prayed in, we are sort of stepping into the etheric matrix of Prophet Muhammad. We are beginning to resonate. We're in morphic resonance with this prophet that we love. And that may add something to our worship. And I think that's a very important aspect of it.
That just comes to the second part. I was just thinking about the way you mentioned about horses. There's a part of me that wants both to contain, and there's a part that wants to be wild. This sense of the horse, for example, just a wildness as a great quality, but it also is great to see a horse that's tame. Of use to, there's a sense of wanting to expand into my own, but also wanting to be tamed, to be.
Yes. Yes. I think we all understand that to some extent, and but it may be that what is truly possible for us is much higher than either of those alternatives, and that those alternatives, especially the wildness, may just be, as one great Sufi saint put it, just one of the frivolities of the ego. Self-induced, self-intended ecstasy or wildness is one thing. The real ecstasy of being taken out of yourself is something else. And the freedom of being freed of your own nafs and what it wants. You just described it. Part of me wants this and part of me wants that. It's the two-way pull. That one calls it the two-way pull. And he has advice on what it takes to get beyond the two-way pull. Under this, or that. I want this, but I don't want that. I can't have both. So this is the perpetual human condition. So those who have attained freedom, freedom in the divine reality, are liberated into a one-way pull, where they are directly geared to the divine intelligence. And it is both no freedom and complete freedom. It's no freedom because you're not free to choose something stupid. In that sense, it's no freedom. But it's ultimate freedom in that you are an expression of the divine intelligence and love without any second thoughts, without any hesitation. And I can speak about it. I'm not claiming to have it. Maybe in moments we've known this, in moments we have. Moments we live this way, we experience that that is possible. And how we got there is a very subtle matter. Rumi says in so many ways, stop being the hunter, become the prey. Make yourself God's prey. So some of the ways that we do that look counter to individuality, counter to creative expression. And it's such a subtle matter, you know, because utter humility, utter trust, becoming nothing. We talk about these things. And there's a true way that that can be lived, and there are also pathological versions of it. So, in conclusion, we're going to break soon, but what I would say in conclusion is that the spiritual path as a whole, a tradition that has been a tradition that is not a tradition of just imitatively repeating again and again and again, but a tradition based in Rumi is a tradition constantly transcending itself in freedom and creativity, and yet remaining true to its original impulse. And with it, the adag that we have, the ceremonies, the ayins, we have all of the richness of the tradition. Everything, every aspect of the tradition is pointing us to one thing. Is coherent in that way. So you can almost pick up any part of it and be led to the center. That's the beauty of it. And we won't get there by our own will, and yet we won't get there without exercising our will. We won't get there through our efforts, nor will we get there without any efforts. So these are very subtle matters, and love comes in again. Often love is the answer to many dilemmas that the intellect cannot resolve.